From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning, I speak with physical therapist and pelvic floor expert, Dr. Christina Hansen, the founder of Uplift Pelvic Health and Wellness. Christina is a Park City resident, and she will help us learn a lot about maybe what we only know a little bit about regarding the pelvic floor when we return. And then in the second half of the hour, Abundant Ever After podcast host, book author, and transformational coach Kathy Heller points us toward a life of abundance and away from scarcity as we wrap up this year and move into the next. That all coming up this hour. Stay with us. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Well, pelvic floor issues are common, but perhaps we don't often talk about them. We just accept them. Health and wellness is very important to us here at The Mountain Life. So we invited Dr. Christina Hansen, the founder of Uplift Pelvic Health and Wellness, to talk to us about helping you regain confidence in your body to return to the activities you love with less pain and greater health, and to get the support you need to fully heal. And what are we healing from? Well, bladder leakage, pelvic pain, pregnancy and postpartum pelvic recovery, and much more. Dr. Christina Hansen, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. What a great introduction, Lynn. I'm very excited to be here and to have this conversation with you today.
Well, it's an important conversation. And, you know, we talk a lot here on The Mountain Life about a lot of different health issues. This is one that I don't know. I mean, to what degree do you feel like this is a taboo thing that even women don't talk about amongst themselves?
I think it's still taboo. And I think having conversations like this, the more we can have them, the more we can break down those barriers. We take away the stigma. We take away the shame. We take away that this isn't something we talk about. I mean, even talking about our anatomy and not calling it our privates or our no-no zones and naming what it is. I think giving things names takes away that fear or that shame that they have.
Absolutely. Well, let's just start with the fact that our bodies and our anatomy is designed to bear children. And for anyone who's ever been through childbirth or witnessed childbirth, especially the men in our lives, you know, looking at it, it's just absolutely phenomenal that our bodies can go back to even some semblance of what they were before we gave birth. But can you talk about what happens to our physiology, whether it's our pelvic girdle or any of the rest of it that happens specifically during childbirth?
I think to first start by saying, once you've had a baby, that postpartum body is a new body, and we need to retrain that new body so that it doesn't end up with injuries. So physiologically, we increase our blood volume by 50%. Our pelvis, our pelvic girdle, so there are two bones that come together, actually widen in preparation to allow baby to come in through the birth canal. And oftentimes I see actually postpartum, the pelvis has stayed in that what I would call an open birth position. So that's the first thing that we're assessing in a postpartum body. What is the position of that pelvis? So there's the sacrum, which if you guys can envision your spine, you have your skull, you have all of the vertebrae, those bones of your back. And at the bottom of them, you have your sacrum, which is a triangular bone that connects to each half of the pelvis. It has to, essentially the bottom part where the tailbone is, has to open in order for the pelvis to open. So what is the position of the sacrum as well? How is that influencing the system? Now, if you think about, since this is radio, you guys can't see what my hands are doing, but if you can envision where, if you're sitting right now, between your sit bones, your pelvic floor muscles go from one sit bone to the other sit bone. They go all the way to the front at the bottom part of your pubic bone. So if you find your bladder and you find that bone just below it, your pelvic floor muscles go from that all the way back to the tailbone. So now if you've just had a baby or even at the end of pregnancy, and that pelvis is opening, think about what's happening to all of the muscles. They're all elongating, lengthening. Now you have a baby, your cervix has just maximally opened, your vaginal canal has done its job in expanding, but how can we help it restore that length tension relationship, that coordination, and also get that bony anatomy, that pelvis, back into what I call a closed birth position? So those muscles don't have to constantly be on a stretch.
Right. As you were talking, Christina, it made me think about the relative health of even like where our hormones are, and down to something as simple as our levels of, you know, potassium and magnesium, and, you know, helping those things come back to, you know, an equilibrium. So talk about those factors that play in before our pelvic girdle starts to stretch and expand and our sacrum tips and all that. What are the things coming into it that determine the outcome later on?
Oh, gosh. So there are different factors. So one of the questions you'd asked me before this talk was, are there genetic factors? And in fact, there can be genetic factors. So we can talk about the distance of some of the landmarks underneath the pelvis. So between the urethra and the vaginal opening, the shorter that distance, the more likely the tissues are to tear. So that's where actually preparing the pelvic floor muscles during pregnancy can be really helpful to reduce the likelihood of tearing. Also, some other factors, a significant portion of the nerves that go to the pelvic floor to communicate its functions are strongly connected to the autonomic nervous system. So things that happen automatically without us thinking, like think heart rate, digestion, breathing. Well, our pelvic floor is very much on that same vein. Things happen automatically. So if we're taking a mom who is in pregnancy, who maybe has a lot of stress in her life, maybe a lot of fear of the pending birth, all of those things influence what's happening to the pelvic floor and its natural physiologic responses. So through education, through training, if we can adjust that perception of what's going to happen in birth and also help regulate the nervous system, teaching people to regulate their nervous system, whether that's pregnancy or really any other time, we can positively influence what happens in the pelvic floor just by regulating the nervous system. So to me, when we talk about the physiology, I like to look at that nervous system component. How is our body responding to stress? And I know we're talking about pregnant bodies, but really our bodies hold tension in different ways. We can also talk about how our bodies hold tension through trauma. And so people hold tension from stress a lot of times in their jaw, in their neck and shoulders, or in their pelvic floor. And that can manifest in a lot of different ways. We can also talk about how the jaw and the pelvic floor are connected. But anyway, our nervous system is a big factor in what happens to our pelvic floor, whether that's in pregnancy and delivery, whether that's in perimenopause, menopause, all of the stages.
So interesting. So you talked a little bit about what happens during pregnancy, but what happens during perimenopause, and then what happens once you're postmenopausal?
Great question. So as we go into the perimenopausal stage, which for those of you who are listening who aren't familiar with it, really perimenopause happens 10 to 15 years before menopause. And menopause by definition is 12 months of not having had a menstrual cycle. So really it's a day. It's perimenopause that's really about a third of our life. And it can start, so the average age of menopause is around 51, 52. So if it starts 10 to 15 years before, as early as 35, women can be experiencing a decline in their hormone levels. And one of the systems in our body that's affected is our urogenital system. So our urinary tract, our genitals, so our pelvic floor muscles. So typically, we'll actually start to see an increase in pelvic floor dysfunction, namely leaking, urgency, maybe more dryness, maybe more pain with intercourse. A lot of that is due to decreased hormones. And so there may have been an underlying pelvic floor dysfunction that wasn't addressed. Now we have declining hormones, and now it really unmasks itself and becomes more prevalent. So really, we know that postmenopausally, statistically, women up to 50 to 65% will end up having prolapse or end up having some form of pelvic floor dysfunction. So anytime we can treat this, But the earlier you start having signs of dysfunction, the better that we get in and we solve these problems so it doesn't keep haunting you as you go through your life.
Christina, maybe a different question, a different approach is, what do those women have in common who skate through childbirth, perimenopause, and menopause and never have any pelvic floor dysfunction? What did they have that the rest of us don't? And what is that? Then what is that percentage?
That's a great question because I don't see those people. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they exist. I don't
Yeah,
see
so
them though.
maybe, yeah, structurally, genetically, they're set up correctly, and maybe their distribution of hormones over their decades just has worked better. I don't know.
Yeah, so then are they people that manage their stress really well? Is it that their lifestyle is super dialed in? So they exercise appropriately, not overexercise, not underexercise. They keep up on their mobility. They aren't on either end of the spectrum being super hypermobile, where their joints have a lot of laxity, or the other spectrum where everything's stiff, tight, and rigid. They're somewhere in that middle range. So who's that person that sleeps really well? Tolerates stress or manages their stress extremely well, eats well, like lives the perfect lifestyle. That sounds like a great, I would, that sounds like something to aspire to be.
It sure does. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Christina Hansen. She's the founder of Uplift Pelvic Health and Wellness. Oh, and remind us where you are located.
So I'm a resident of Park City and my practice is actually in Mill Creek. So it's right on the border of Mill Creek and Holiday, 4190 South Highland Drive.
Fairly close to the mouth of the canyon. And how many people do you see from the, Summit and Wasatch County areas? Do you have a big part of your practice?
I do still probably about, I would say maybe 20% come from Wyoming, and Wasatch Back area, but I also have people that come from Provo, Ogden, and then the majority would be, I'd say, in the Salt Lake Valley.
Okay. Well, since you mentioned it, what is the connection between your jaw and your pelvic region?
So from the nervous system and the nerve innervations, how the jaw and the pelvic floor are neurologically wired. They're connected that way. And also, if we go back to embryology, when we were first developing in our mother's womb, we started out as a tube within a tube. So the mouth opening and the other opening were just one line. So both embryologically and neurologically, they're wired together. So oftentimes, when people are coming in with pelvic floor issues, I'm oftentimes screening what is going on with their jaw. And also, if you have jaw issues, there's a very high likelihood that something is going on with your pelvic floor as well.
Wow, you also mentioned trauma, and I do recall this with actually one of your former colleagues, Heather DeFord, who I saw. And the first question that she asked me was, about that question, have you ever had any, sexual abuse or trauma or anything like that? Which I was surprised at that question, but I think from what you've been saying, is that's a question that's needed to be able to establish what kind of stress you have going into it. Is there a way that you, as a doctor of physical therapy, can surmount those issues?
Yeah, great question. So I like to, number one, I think it's really important to know somebody's trauma history if they're comfortable talking about it. In the state of Utah, statistically, 7 in 10 women have experienced some form of sexual trauma, 1 in 3 by the age of 18. So sexual trauma is just one trauma, and you would think that connects strongly to the pelvic floor, but there's also, so I'd call that like a big T trauma. But we also have small T traumas in our life. Maybe it was emotional abuse, maybe it was some other traumatic things that happened, falling off a bike in a traumatic way. I mean, there's all sorts of strange things that happen, and our body holds on to that oftentimes. And so understanding somebody's trauma history, understanding where their body is at and how they're responding. So we respond to traumatic events in our nervous system. So we have that sympathetic fight or flight. That's part of our trauma response too. It's also our hypervigilant part. But with trauma, we respond to it by fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And so I like to know where somebody's at because somebody's not necessarily always in fight or flight. They might be in fawning. So they might be going along with something, even though inside there's turmoil and they don't feel safe. So it's good to recognize where they're at and help them work through that. Then we get pretty quickly to the end of what physical therapy can do in a physical medicine practice. So I oftentimes will partner with mental health providers. And so if we're dealing with a lot of trauma in the body, and I don't know who doesn't have trauma, I think that's just, it's just to what extent, and how is that influencing their ability to move through a program with us. And so oftentimes, especially with various types of chronic pelvic pain, having them work with a mental health provider in conjunction with what we're doing, I found has been so incredibly helpful.
Wow, this is all so interesting. Okay, let's go back to the bladder. Now, it's funny today. I mean, I would say 99.9% of what we're talking about pertains to women, but men have their own issues going on in their pelvis with their prostate. And it's a fact that men also go through some issues with their bladder slash prostate and leakage and that sort of thing. So men, you can listen up to this as well. And it is an embarrassing thing. But let's talk about bladder leakage. There are three different types: stress, urge, and
Mixed.
oh,
There's
and
actually
mix.
a fourth, which is called overflow, and that's going to be more in our male population. So stress, urinary incontinence is leakage with a like a stimulus to the body, coughing, sneezing, laughing, jumping. Urge urinary incontinence is a overwhelmingly strong desire to urinate right away, and your body can't hold it in, and it starts to leak a little, moderate, or a lot. Mixed incontinence is you have urgency and you have stress urinary incontinence combined. And then overflow is a lot of times related to men who have a prostate that's enlarged, that is narrowing the urethra where the urine comes out of, and then it overfills because it can't come through, and then they just leak. So those are the main types that we're talking about, both men and women.
This reminds me of a funny story. A friend was telling me that her young son sneezed, and she noticed that every time he sneezed, he would cross his legs. And she said to him, "Why are you crossing your legs when you sneeze?" And she said, or he said, "Well, because you do it and grandma does it every time you sneeze, cross your legs." So I thought that's what you're supposed to do when you sneeze. That would relate to stress incontinence. And so we
That's
know it's very,
adorable.
isn't that adorable? So it's very common, but as you say in your practice, that a lot of people, instead of doing something about it, you just kind of live with it. But we don't need to live with it. Why
You
don't
don't
we?
need to.
How don't we?
Exactly. So the literature actually says women wait nearly 7 years before they seek care for urinary leakage, which is mind-blowing. And I will tell you, oftentimes I will have people that come in my door that leakage was not their reason why they came in the door. It was something else beyond that. And they go, "Oh, well, yeah, I've been leaking urine for years," as though it's just a part of their life. They've accepted it. Urinary incontinence products is a $13 billion a year industry. So we know from the literature, pelvic floor PT has the potential of a 75% near cure rate or most resolution to leakage. So there are options. We can't fix everything. Leakage isn't a diagnosis, it's a symptom. So why is somebody leaking? And that's where it becomes multifactorial. Is it pressure management? Is it prolapse? Is it impaired coordination of the muscles of the pelvic floor and the abdominal muscles? Have they stopped acting in an anticipatory way? So the pelvic floor and the deep core should anticipate movement. They should be the first things on, the last things off. And it's not uncommon for that coordination or that like reflexive response of those muscles to become inhibited through childbirth, through injury, other issues that way. So we retrain that.
Okay, well, you mentioning sort of muscular coordination and things like that, of course, makes me think about Kegels or Kegels or however you say it. How do you say it?
Great question. So it's a German doctor from the 1920s that developed the first biofeedback tool. And because he's German, you would say Kegel. But I'm in the US, so I say Kegel.
Okay.
So
So
I think
either
it's
one is
potato,
fine.
potato.
So I read on your site that Kegels are not always either done correctly or it
Yes.
may not even be what we need. How so?
Great. I love this question. So I think if Kegels were the answer, pelvic health therapists wouldn't need to exist, right? If we just needed to do like cues like that, that'd be amazing. The thing is that the pelvic floor muscles do not work in isolation. They work as part of a system. So if we're not looking at the body as a system, then we're missing what's going on within the pelvic floor. Is it a nervous system? Is it the lack of that reflexive anticipatory response? Is it a pressure management problem? So to me, Kegels is just like the tip of the iceberg of all the things we could do. Furthermore, we're all activating our pelvic floor at various times of the day. It's on, it's supporting our organs, it's providing stability to our pelvis. We shouldn't have to be thinking about it. We start thinking about it when something goes wrong, but we shouldn't need to walk around, say, doing a workout, running down the street, holding a Kegel or a pelvic floor contraction. That might create more problems. I have people that come in and like, oh yeah, I've been doing Kegels and now my issue is worse. And it's like, well, because that wasn't the right intervention for the symptoms you have going on. Again, leakage is a symptom, not a diagnosis. So some people might benefit from that, where other people might need the opposite. And then if we go back to the nervous system, a lot of times we're stuck in a little bit of fight or flight. We're a little bit stressed. So our pelvic floor responds to that, just like we talked about the jaw tension, the neck tension, the pelvic floor tension. So now those muscles are shortened because of stress. So why would we strengthen a shortened muscle? Now it's just going to be stronger and stronger through this smaller range of motion. Then you go and have a sneeze, which needs the full length of the muscle, and it's weak at the end range because it hasn't been there in a while, and it's tight, it's tired because it's been overcontracted in this small range. So we need to be thinking, get the muscle moving through a full range, just like I wouldn't hold a bicep contraction with a weight in it in one position all day and think that I'm strength training. Same thing for the pelvic floor.
Oh, you explained that in such an accessible way. So that's really great to know. Well, this all makes me think that we women at multiple stages of our life need to see a pelvic floor specialist because how do we know if we're holding the wrong kind of tension, right?
Exactly. And the other thing is that we have different types of sensation in our body, right? We have light touch, we feel deep pressure, we feel temperature. We also have a type of sensation called proprioception. That tells us where we are in space. Our pelvic floor muscles don't have very good proprioception because they don't need to hold us upright. And as a result, we tend to not be very connected with what those muscles are doing. And so I have people that are doing online programs, and there are some great online programs. I'm not trying to say anything negative about it, but the way their body interpreted those cues was incorrect. And so now they've actually been bearing down or contracting by bulging as opposed to a lifting because their body interpreted it a different way. So coming in and getting a baseline assessment and getting and just learning how to connect with your body, and especially depending on what your upbringing was, you may not have ever touched yourself. You may not have ever looked at your anatomy. You may not have ever talked about your anatomy. And so you're really not going to be connected with it. So learning to appreciate what it's doing when can be priceless to take you with through the rest of your life.
Can women just come to Uplift Pelvic Health and Wellness, just make an appointment and come in for some kind of diagnostic first visit that's going, they don't have to have a prescription from their family practice doctor to come in? How does it work?
Great question. So, in the state of Utah, physical therapists have direct access, meaning you can just call any clinic and make an appointment and come in. So, yes, you could call today, and we also like to offer free phone consultations because you may not know if this is the right thing for you. What do you know, these are things that you might not even be telling your intimate partners, you might not be telling your doctor. So we don't want to waste people's time. We want to make sure that we can actually provide a solution to what you have going on and that you're coming to the right place.
What are some of the questions are you going to ask? Because it would seem that you need a physical exam to really ascertain what's going on.
Oh, yes. So the phone consultation is just to make sure you're appropriate to come in for an actual in-person assessment. So we'll just be asking what typically do you have going on? What are you experiencing? What are your symptoms? How is it affecting your daily life? That sort of thing. Because sometimes people have things going on, and I'm like, you know, I actually think that sounds like you have an appendicitis. Let's get you to the right medical provider. Like it could be something else. So it's more of just a screening. It's not an actual physical therapy assessment, just to make sure that we're a right fit for each other.
Okay. So we've talked with you this morning, Christina, about bladder leakage. We've talked a little bit about postpartum and perimenopause and menopause. One thing, and we're just about out of time, but you do mention one of your services has to do with bowel dysfunction. Now, this ought to be something that people really don't talk about with their friends at a party.
So true. And around here, we all talk about poops. So, number one, fecal incontinence. Okay. If you're not able to hold in your stool, the number one and number two reason that people are admitted to nursing homes later in life is fecal and urinary incontinence. So, let's solve that problem before you lose cognitive ability. Okay. Number two, constipation. If you are having a hard time, you're not feeling a complete emptying, if you have hemorrhoids, if you have anal fissures, all of those are signs that something is going on within the pelvic floor. And so sometimes, where the stool comes out of, there's actually two muscles, an internal and an external anal sphincter. One is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. One is controlled voluntarily. Sometimes those can become discoordinated, and that discoordination can lead to some of those problems. So retraining the coordination of those muscles can make all the difference. I mean, I've had people email me to be like, I'm having the best bowel movements of my life now. So there's just no reason. If you I had a patient whose wife bought him a poop timer because he was spending so long in the bathroom. So if you have a poop timer, people joke that you're sitting on the toilet too long, you should probably see a pelvic health therapist. And also, if you're just there looking at your phone, don't sit on the toilet for longer than 10 to 15 minutes. It's not helpful for your pelvic floor.
Wow, good to know. Dr. Christina Hansen is the founder of Uplift Pelvic Health and Wellness, and she is a Park City resident. The address, again, 4190 South Highland Drive, that's in Mill Creek, and we will post that link on our website. This has been such great information. Christina, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My next guest, Kathy Heller, is a dynamic transformational coach, a spiritual guide, a meditation teacher, and an inspirational speaker dedicated to helping individuals find ease, joy, and fulfillment in their lives. She's also the host of the Abundant Ever After podcast with over 50 million downloads. And she joins me today to discuss her new book just out. It's called Abundant Ever After. Kathy Heller, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh my gosh, I love your voice. It's so soothing and beautiful. I'm like, I'll just listen to you talk. That'd be the best use of my time.
Well, thank you. I don't think my husband would say the same thing, or my kids.
That's hilarious, because when people tell me like, oh, I love your content and you can just talk for hours, I'm like, yeah, you appreciate it. My husband's like, save your voice. You get paid to do this.
We are in the same boat for sure. Okay, abundant ever after. When I hear the word abundance, I think also of the flip side of abundance, which I would label as scarcity. So you either come from this abundance mindset or a scarcity mindset, but I think we're all probably mixtures of both. I wanted to start by asking you, who is that person who has the abundance mindset? And then conversely, who's the person who has the scarcity mindset? What do they do in their day?
Wow, that's a beautiful question. I haven't been asked that question. I like it. You know, I think the reason it's such a healthy question is because we have to define our terms, first of all, right? Like if you go to Alaska, they actually have many words for snow because you can't just say it's snowing. They're like, Well, it's always snowing. What kind of snow? What does snow mean to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the word God, for instance, also is like, it means many things to many people. It's like, what does it mean to you, right? So to me, we are either in flow state or we're not. Another way to say that is we're either in receptive mode or we're in some kind of resistant mode. And we're either operating from our soul, sort of from our heart, or we're operating from our mind. And both of those two tracks, one is sort of fear-based and one is sort of that part of us that's not afraid, right? Like there is this equanimity that lives inside of all of us that's always within reach. I mean, there is a part of us that's beyond time, it's beyond space, it's beyond the material world. And it longs for the feeling within us that is like that open-hearted feeling, right? And that always exists. It's always available is my point. You can find it inside of you at the DMV. You can find it inside of you in traffic. You can find it inside of you at Thanksgiving dinner, even if your uncle is annoying. Like I'm just saying it exists, okay? Now, what's interesting is in terms of how it plays out in the material world, like how we live our lives, is that people are often, they're thinking, right? By the way, you know, there's no answers in the mind. All the answers are in the heart. So wisdom doesn't come from the mind. It actually comes from somewhere else. And as Einstein said, it's like the mind, when it's really being in use, it's actually an antenna to pick up what's in the field. So that is a whole other expansive layer to how much abundance there is in terms of the abundance of thought, the abundance of perception, the abundance of our capacity to feel so much greater than what the back of the brain, this amygdala, lives in scarcity all day long. So when you take two people and you think about somebody who's in scarcity mindset and somebody who's in abundance mindset, there's obviously multiple layers to this, but the way I would like quickly answer it, if we are unconscious, then our mind is hardwired into scarcity because the amygdala part of our brain was created to protect us. And so in order to do that, it tells you worst case scenarios all day long. It is a fear, it's a fear tracker. And the reason most people meditate, or not most people, but I would say a lot of happy people have some kind of meditation or prayer practice or some kind of practice that gets them into the present moment, is to become conscious of that unconscious noise. There are so many things, by the way, that can help a person get beyond that mind besides meditation. And a person who has abundance mindset knows that all of the greatest abundance lives within themselves. A person who knows that they're not after success, they're after significance, and you can be significant at the bus stop. And so when you live that way, it's such a high vibration that what will happen is physical 3D abundance won't miss you. You'll wind up having both material and spiritual wealth because we are living in a vibrational world, a world of atoms, a world of frequency. And when your frequency is so connected to the divine, so connected to the oneness, so connected to that yumminess, you wind up being a magnet for a lot of beauty. And so a scarcity conscious person is a person who's really in separation consciousness, which is the ego, and therefore is constantly ruled by feeling that something outside of themselves is what is needed to change. So they either need to change something that's happening that somebody else is doing, or they need to achieve something outside of themselves in order to feel abundant. When you actually are abundant, it's the inner that affects the outer. That's the best way I could describe that.
Well, that was great. How do we check? How do we bring awareness into if you're coming at it with openness and possibility versus shutdown and reasons why it won't work? And for those people who have brought awareness to it, you feel yourself when you're approaching something with a negativity, because you are coming up with what the roadblocks are, why this won't work. But for those people who've never really brought awareness to it before, what are those questions we can ask ourselves?
I think that it's really interesting what you're talking about, because I think we all know that experience well. We've all had those kinds of moments multiple times a day, multiple times a week, multiple times a year. The part of the brain that spits out those kinds of limiting beliefs, what it wants is certainty, right? Because it's afraid of the unknown. The opposite of fear, though, is not certainty. The opposite of fear is infinite possibility. And so really successful people, you know, JFK said, we're going to put a man on the moon. And when he said those words, they had no clue how on earth they were going to do that. It's funny, I said, how on earth, how in the universe they would do that. But he said it. And so now it's a, we call that a moonshot when somebody sees beyond what somebody else could see. We call that a moonshot because that was, they did it. They landed on the moon. And I think that, you know, Walt Disney, there's a famous story that Walt Disney was with a helicopter pilot and they were flying over swampland in Anaheim. And he said, look out the window. Do you see this? And he's like, the swamp? And he's like, no, this is, there's going to be a whole world here. And the tears started to stream down his face. So we were born to be able to create infinite possibility. The mind is not that interesting. Fear is really boring. And so how do you check? Well, if you're constantly coming up with a story that says, this won't work, it's not possible, or I'm not enough, you're afraid of what's possible because you'd rather choose comfort. Fear is actually, it's the comfort that we know, even though it's so uncomfortable. You know, in the biblical history, which is, this is just history, when the Jews left Egypt with Moses, this is, I mean, that's just like historical, only 20% of them left. 80% of them stayed there because they would rather choose slavery. They'd rather choose being in bondage in Egypt than this possibility of where the hell are we going beyond here, right? So how many times have you seen a person or known a person who's staying in a job that they're settling for in a relationship that's not working because they are unable to feel that there is something greater, a greater possibility beyond the reef? Another way you can check is just to check in with your body, because all day long, your body is either, it's either regulated and calm or it's dysregulated. And if you ask yourself, like, well, how's my body doing right now? You'll notice, like, is my heart racing? Is my stomach tight? Or am I just really at peace? And it's really a sad commentary because most people, when they check in, they find that their body is not at rest. And that's usually because the mind is playing some story that you're buying into as fact. You know, thoughts are not facts. Yeah. They're just thoughts. And so I think that's another good way to check.
That's a good way. Thoughts are not facts. I think that there are many people, and probably myself included, where when I check in with my body, I'm not sure what that feeling is. Is this what stress feels like? I don't know. Is this what calm feels like? I don't know. And also, when I see the word authentic, like living an authentic life, how do people even know what's authentic? I mean, I know what I think I like. I know what brings me joy. I know that getting on my mountain bike and riding the trails around Park City gives me so much joy. What if I just think it gives me joy? And really what I'm meant to be doing is playing 18 holes of golf, which I find extremely frustrating and not full of a lot of joy.
There's a couple of things that I think we could say about this. Number one, the dreams that you wind up really being meant to dream are the dreams that chase you back. The dreams you chase that chase you back are the dreams you're meant to chase. Because there's a river, there's a flow to things. You know, life is actually meant to be really easy. And it sounds really controversial to say that because we're really bought into the harder we work, the more gold stars we get. But if you look out, like I'm looking right now at the mountains behind my house, there's nothing in nature that's rushing. Nothing is worried because they are all part of an ecosystem that's taking care of itself all the time. So are we. And people, when they actually are really just following the river, the flow of their life, everything is synchronicity. How you meet your husband, how you know the best friend, you never figured that out. You didn't put pencil to paper. It just, you were in the right place at the right time. Well, you're always in the right place at the right time. And when you are awake and available to really be in alignment and know what that feels like, it's constantly leading you to where you're meant to be. I mean, I moved out to LA to get a record deal. I had a record deal at Interscope. I was watching Lady Gaga recording Paparazzi with these amazing violins. And then quickly after, I was dropped from the record label And then eventually I started a podcast. And it's interesting because I moved to LA with this whisper of, I want to use my voice. Just like that was the right fat path. I didn't have to try or push or hustle, right? It was just where the Venn diagram sort of all came together. But what I also want to say about authenticity is that my friend Mark says something really powerful, Mark Groves. He says that all day long, whether people are aware of it or not, they're making a choice between belonging and being authentic. And most of the time they choose belonging. But what happens is if you do that, if you choose not to be totally expressed and totally honest, then you're really self-abandoning. And when you abandon yourself and then you think you belong to someone, you don't belong to anyone because they didn't choose you. They don't really know what you actually think. You're people pleasing. And I wonder sometimes every single day, what would you post on Instagram if you were just willing to be honest? What would you say to your sister? What would you do? What would you charge for your services? Would you ask for more money? Like, we're always afraid that people won't like us, so we won't live our authentic life. And then the reward is that when you actually choose to be yourself, you give other people permission to be themselves. And it's amazing the reward you get for that courage. So I think that's what the real authentic decision is every day, is living your life and saying, I know there's 20 people coming for Thanksgiving, but instead of saying, no, you don't need to bring anything, I'm gonna say, it would be great if you could. And when I'm tired at 9:30, instead of just staying there till 11, I'm gonna say, I'm gonna excuse myself and go to sleep, but you're welcome to stay. Like, we don't live our lives authentically, and we are so depleted because of that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you studied in Jerusalem Jewish mysticism for 3 years, and that was sort of the onset or the genesis maybe of your mindfulness practice. And I was really curious about that. Can you talk about the connection there and how it spurred you into a mindfulness practice?
Yeah, I mean, it was such an incredible trip, and I was supposed to be there for 3 weeks, and I extended my trip for 3 years, and I lived in King David's Old City. I mean, it was just really, you know, people talk about having experiences, right? And I know some people have gone to India and some people have found this vortex in Sedona, Arizona. All of that is true. I mean, there's palpable magical energy in different parts of the world. That's definitely true about Jerusalem. And it's definitely true about living in that old city of Jerusalem, because you're walking 3,000-year-old stone steps where the most incredible energy sort of flows through. I went there sort of on a trip and then accidentally had the most amazing string of coincidences that made me stay. And I'll tell you exactly how it leads to a mindfulness practice, because the very first lesson I ever learned, it was the day before I was supposed to leave for the airport after the first 3 weeks was over. This was supposed to be the end of my trip. And my friend said, you know, why don't you come with me? There's this amazing rabbi, and he's also teaching a meditation class. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting combo. I'll go with you. So he writes the word for the Sabbath on the board, which in Hebrew is the word Shabbat, right? The Sabbath. And he said, does anyone know the first time this is ever used in the Bible, in the Torah? And I'm like, no. And he's like, the first time this word is ever used is actually to describe a meditation. When Abraham is meditating, it uses this word. And then the next line is that when Abraham sat and meditated, God appears. And so he said, that is actually the meaning of the word, the Sabbath. It's a day of that stillness. And whenever you meditate, God appears. And that was so mind-blowing to me. It was so beautiful that I wanted to extend my trip. And I did. And the next thing that happened is I met this amazing rabbi teacher who's influenced my life probably more than anyone, Rabbi David Aaron, who lives in the old city with his 7 children and his wife, Anna. And he said to me, you are someone because you're some of the one. You're a masterpiece because you're a piece of the master. And he described to me that the idea of Abraham was not that there is one God, which, yes, Abraham is the father of like monotheism, but he said it's much deeper than that. What Abraham actually said is that God is one, meaning if God is infinite, there's nowhere God isn't. And so it's not as if there's one God over there, but we're all in this oneness, just like an ocean where every wave is connected to every other wave. and all those waves are part of the ocean. We live in this infinite field, and we're each part of this oneness, part of this consciousness. The idea of a mindfulness practice, a meditation practice, is such an organic outgrowth of that, because the idea, when I'm meditating, I am finding the part of me that's beyond time, beyond space, my soul, part of me that is, was, and will be, and is connected to the divine. And we're all intrinsically connected to that.
That's really interesting. Well, the second chapter in your book, Abundant Ever After, is called Connecting to the Divine. And the way that you're describing it, for those whose religion has perhaps kept them from engaging in meditation and mindfulness. I mean, we see that too, right?
Oh my gosh. I mean, what people find this radical when I say this, they can't believe it's true, but in Judaism, we don't convert people to be Jewish. People go, really? I go, yeah, why do you think there's only 15 million Jews in the world? And then they say, well, why do you do that? Why don't you convert people to be Jewish? The answer is that everyone's already connected to God. Why would you have to be Jewish to be connected? Being Jewish is like a peoplehood. It's in my DNA. My husband and I had certain diseases we carried because we're both Jewish. Like if you did 23andMe, it would tell me I'm Jewish. You don't need to be Jewish to be connected to God. You could be a person who lives in the deep Amazon rainforest, you'd be connected to God. It doesn't matter what your religion is. You can't not be connected to the universe. You are a soul, right? I say that because that's how one we believe we are. That's how different we see the world than everybody else, right? Which is why we also believe there's a million languages that can get people to God, right? It's different languages. But some languages actually keep people from God, because they create it creates a message where they really feel shame. They really feel small. They really feel like God is separate from them and up in the sky somewhere judging them. That's so not Jewish that it's hard for me to even believe that some people could feel that way. But I'm sure there are also Jewish people who for some reason have adopted that belief because they saw it in some movie or read some book, and they just don't know what it really is. To me, it was extremely mind-blowing, because I grew up without any kind of organized religion. My parents, I mean, were Jewish, but we didn't celebrate anything. And my rabbi said to me, your parents, being at the time, I think they thought they were atheists, he's like, they're actually way closer to belief in God than everybody else, because they're really perceiving that actually it's something much bigger and something more spiritual, which is actually the truth. But yeah, I think that there is a part of us that knows that it's not of us. You know, when we measure flow state, right? When Michael Jordan is playing basketball, or Michelangelo is painting the Sistine Chapel, or Tom Petty is playing the guitar, every time you will hear a person like that say, I don't know, I just move out of the way and something bigger than me moves through me. That's God, right? If you're the pen, God's the author. And the moon, for instance, doesn't have light, but what the moon does is it reflects the light of the sun. Our body is like a light bulb, and our soul is the light. Our soul is a piece of God, right? And so when we move out of this, like Ram Dass said, we're all wearing a somebody suit. But when we take away the story of this little tiny person and you move into the part of you that is just really powerful, it's something bigger than you, that you are connected to, that moves through you. You know, my grandmother went through horrible persecution and came to this country as a little girl, totally poverty stricken, never went to school, right? And meanwhile, she was so wise because she was so loving, right? The most impressive person in the room is not where they went to college or what car they're driving. It's the love that they emit. We all have that. What is that? That's something bigger than us. And so we're all looking for that. There is nothing outside of us. And that feels as good as finding that connection to something so much more expansive, which is why you love to go mountain biking, because nature is so fully thriving with the presence and the divinity and the magic of the universe that it's such an incredible way to be with God. So I think you're right on. I think the way you see it is right on.
Well, let's hope so. Abundant Ever After is the book, and my guest is Kathy Heller. And Kathy, I just have to say, you know, a lot of books about, you know, if you go into the self-help genre, come across my desk, and a lot of times I pass them up. This one I kept going back to, and I kept going back to, and I thought, I need to talk to this woman. There's something about it that really hits. So just briefly before I let you go, I have not heard your podcast yet, but you do a great job with it. So just give our listeners a little glimpse into it.
First of all, you just brought tears to my eyes because it was so genuine and kind and such a nice thing to say. And it really feels like so satisfying and fulfilling to write something and somebody said, I kept going back to it. I'm like, oh my God, it like really touches me so deeply. Yeah, I started this podcast 8 years ago when my youngest daughter was 3 weeks old. And I have two other older daughters. So I had a 3-week-old, a 3-year-old, and a 4.5-year-old. When I first started the podcast, it was not called what it is called now. Now, 8 years later, it's sort of pivoted. It's called Abundant Ever After. When I first started it, it was called Don't Keep Your Day Job. And it was about how every one of us is really seeking purpose and that every one of us has a purpose. And so instead of feeling really kind of meh at work, you know, what if you found your soul's calling? And so it was about finding your calling. And so we interviewed people and we spoke to people who did things that they loved that they couldn't believe they got paid to do because they felt so in purpose. Everyone that I had interviewed, it seemed like they had had some capacity to turn on their flow state where they could get into creative thought, they could get into expansive mode. And we started to sort of peel back the curtain on that and say, how do you really manifest? How do you really become hyper, super conscious? And so the podcast sort of morphed into that. It's been an incredible ride. And we've gotten to, you know, sit down with Deepak Chopra and Matthew McConaughey and Marianne Williamson and Tony Robbins and Jimmy Choo. And I mean, if you name a person who's been out there doing things in the world who's somewhat interesting, we've sort of sat down with those people.
Again, the book is Abundant Ever After, Tools for Creating a Life of Prosperity and Ease.
Thank you so much for having me on.